Okay. Looks like I'm going to be chained to the podium today because my remote is not working. But anyway, it's fine. We'll regroup. So we are not in the middle, but have just begun a summer series exploring unity metaphysical principles. And our main texts for this little series are Heart-Centered Metaphysics by Reverend Paul Hasselbeck. He was the dean of Unity Institute for many years. And the accompanying workbook, which is co-authored by Reverend Cher Holden. So last week we said that metaphysics really means the study of the ultimate reality beyond what we see with our human eyes and with our human senses, beyond what we take in. So metaphysicians ask about fundamental questions of truth. Questions such as, what's the nature of God? What's the nature of humankind? Well, come on. I forgot that this wasn't working, but it didn't forget, okay? What is the relationship between humankind and God? And finally, what's the purpose of our existence? So as you can see, not all questions can be answered by Google, right? Those are pretty deep questions. Well, in a parable told by Anthony DeMello, he's an Indian Jesuit priest and psychotherapist, it seems a woman was in a coma dying, and suddenly she had this feeling of being lifted up to the pearly gates to see if she was going to be allowed in. Now, you can tell right away this is not a Unity story, right? But we're going to go with it anyway because there are deep truths in it. So the voice came booming out and said, "Who are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm the wife of the mayor of our town." And the voice said, "I didn't ask you whose wife you were. I asked you, who are you?" She said, "Well, I'm the mother of four children." The voice said, "I didn't ask whose mother you are. I asked, who are you?" And then she said, "Well, I'm a school teacher." And he said, "Did I ask your profession? I ask, help me out with this. I ask, who are you?" And then she said, well, I'm a Christian. He said, "I didn't ask about your religion. I asked, who are you?" Finally, she said, well, I do all sorts of good things at my church. I help with the poor. I help with the homeless. I make food packages." He said, I didn't ask how you served. I asked, who are you?" Well, obviously, she failed the test, and she got sent back to Earth, okay? However, once she recovered from her illness, she spent the rest of her life exploring and learning about who she was. And that has made all the difference. So we're going to talk about that today. Sometimes we tend to identify ourselves as the roles we play, do we not? You know, we identify ourselves by, our professions, our hobbies, our family situation. But the thing is, we looked last week at the difference between absolute and relative truth. And remember, relative truth is from the physical realm. It is not permanent. Absolute truth is lasting, enduring. It is absolutely there for all eternity, and it is from God. So here's the question. Are all those roles we play, profession and position in family and hobbies and clubs we belong to, are those absolute truths? No, they're all going to fade away. The foundational absolute truth of every single one of us, no matter who we are, this is without exception, is that we are eternal spiritual beings, individualized expressions of God. And I personally believe that each of us is here to discover our grand reason for being. It'll all be different, as our daily word said. We're very diverse, but we all have a reason to be. And our quest for truth begins with self-knowledge. You know thyself was inscribed on the temple of Apollo in Delphi. And actually, when my husband and I were in Israel and in the Middle East, over the doors of many temples all the way throughout the Middle East, the ancient world. And Unity co-founder Charles Fillmore wrote, "This must also be inscribed in your own temple, the temple of your own minds. Knowing yourself means knowing who and what you are, where you came from, and what you are doing here." According to Aristotle, knowing yourself is the beginning of all wisdom. So Paul Hesselbeck says in his book, self-knowledge is the realization that we have a dimension of our minds that is even greater than our thinking selves. It can evaluate and make decisions about what it observes. If it chooses, it can control, change, and adjust what the thinking self is doing. So throughout the ages, humankind seeks knowledge. It's just we're part of our DNA. We want to know things. We seek knowledge. And many of us pursue that in a myriad of places. Where do we look? Books, classes, people we consider experts, right? From Google and YouTube. You know, that's where we look for knowledge. Eventually, however, we understand that wisdom is not about cramming facts into our heads. Rather, it is connecting with the truths that are already there. Wisdom is within. Emily Cady wrote, "The source of all knowledge, the very spirit of truth, is lying latent within each one of us, just waiting to be revealed." Now, at the turn of the century, educational theory, based on the philosophy of John Locke, was that children are born without mental content and come to school like blank slates, just waiting for their teachers to fill up their little empty minds, right? Well, that is very ironic that that was ever an educational theory, because the word educate is from the Latin educare, which means to draw out what is already there. Now, any of us, who have worked with children know that this is absolutely true, right? I had my 4-year-old grandson last week, and we were reading a picture book about outer space. And we turned the page, and one of the pictures showed the astronaut up in the space capsule with only his feet dangling. And, of course, I go right into teacher mode. That's my way to do it. And I was trying to explain to him why that happened with using the right vocabulary and making sure he could understand. And he listened patiently, and then he looked at me and goes, "Grandma?" I said, "What?" He goes, "That's called gravity." And I said, "John, where in the world did you ever learn the word gravity? That's such a great word." He goes, "I don't know, but I think I always knew it." Yep, out of the mouths of babes. That's the truth, out of the mouths of babes. So Paul says the key to human self-knowledge, with a little s, and spiritual self-knowledge, with a big s, is the awareness that true knowledge comes from within. We are all one in the mind of God and with the mind of God. In what Eric Butterworth calls the most majestic statement in the Bible, we read, there's Paul's quote. We read, "So God created humankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them." Bible scholar Ed Townley writes, I love this description of this particular Bible verse. He writes, "God is the spirit and power that begins in chaos, moves upon the waters, and chooses to create of itself. This means we are created as spirit, creative, discerning, and loving. We are on this earth to express the goodness and love that we are." So spiritual growth, one of our core values, really is an ever-increasing awareness of our oneness, and that awareness can only be in our own consciousness. We have the freedom of choice concerning what to do with our divine identity, our spiritual I am. And the most intriguing thing about our consciousness is that it is pivotal. I was trying to find a visual aid that was pivotal, but I didn't come up with one, so I used my hand. Our consciousness can swing at any time to the outer world, where we tend to believe everything we see is the only reality, or it can swing to the inner, the Christ within, where all power, intelligence, and wisdom reside. The choice is up to us. And that means we're able to see and evaluate both realities, which is pretty amazing. So, to draw ourselves to all the divine ideas of goodness, we must give that inner life priority. We must look within. This is beautifully illustrated in one of my personal favorite Bible stories, and it is Luke 10, verses 38 to 42. "And Jesus and his disciples were on their way. He came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to them. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the who sat at the Lord's feet, listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. Anybody ever been there? Distracted by preparation? She came to him and said, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? Tell her to help me." And Jesus looks at her and says, "Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better." Some versions say the better part. "And it will not be taken away from her." Now, for a long time, Bible scholars really depicted the two, I would say with superficial interpretation, my opinion. Mary was treated as the good sister, you know, who listened to Jesus and sat there quietly. And Martha was depicted as the bad sister for being more concerned about household tasks. So to get a deeper meaning here, we might ask ourselves, why does Jesus chastise Martha for serving him? And what does he mean about there being only one thing and Mary taking the greater part? Well, Charles Fillmore says that the two sisters represent love operating on different levels of awareness. Martha represents the soul turned to the outer duties, trying to provide food and drink for her guests. And Mary represents the soul turned to that inner spiritual side. Now we see Jesus as the fully evolved Christ presence, and Mary symbolizes that quiet receptivity that listens to and aligns with the indwelling Christ. Really, the sisters represent two aspects of our consciousness. Day by day, moment by moment, thought by thought, we can turn to the outer world, or we can turn where? Within, absolutely. As spiritual beings having a human experience, sometimes we do need to see to the worldly responsibilities. Does anybody notice that? I mean, there are bills to pay, there's food to prepare, there's grocery shopping to do. That's part of our lives as human beings. But the two women, when you think about it, were Jesus' beloved friends. He respected and loved them both, showing us that both the outer and the inner have value. However, he clearly shows us which he thinks is the better way. When you think about it, as owner of the house, Martha felt the responsibility to take care of Jesus and his followers, right? I mean, really, there was no Panera Bread delivery in the day, right? I mean, she had to get the food ready. But Mary made a different choice. And Jesus, as I said, is very clear about that being the better part, because it will not be taken away from her. Turning her pivotal soul to all the powers of the Christ, she receives spiritual nourishment. So last week we said, life is consciousness. There's this picture of Martha and Mary with Jesus in Luke 10:38-42. Last week we said, life is consciousness. We make our decisions in the outer world based on that which we value and the information we have at the time. So last Wednesday evening, some of us were talking about the storms this week. In my neighborhood, we had a really bad storm and all our power went out. So we were without power for several hours and gave Bob and I a chance to talk and laugh about the choices I had made when we had our whole house generator installed. Well, first of all, I just want to say the term whole house generator is an advertising gimmick. Yeah. Because Bob wasn't home, and when the electrician came, he said, "Which 16 units in your house do you want hooked up?" Well, you know, we had to have, I was smart enough to know we needed the air conditioner, we needed the heater, right? And we needed the refrigerator. Some of my other choices are a little questionable, but I chose to have electricity to my koi pond. I chose no for the laundry room, okay? I chose yes for the modem that operates our laptops. I chose no for the television. Yeah. I chose yes for the light in the office and where I do my meditation. I chose no for the light in the kitchen. I don't quite get that. But at any rate, Bob said to me afterward, I mean, we were talking about this, and he said, "You know what else you did?" He said, "You chose yes for the light on your side of the bed, and you chose no for the light on my side of the bed." However, in the interest of full disclosure, that one did not pass the relative fact test. He was harassing me. I almost believe that I had done it, but I didn't. So the point is, every moment of our lives, we have all these choices. And in Adam Smashing Power of the Mind, Charles Fillmore writes, "All things work from our consciousness, and we have to be able to separate the erroneous from the true, the darkness from the light." So even in a commonplace situation like a traffic jam, getting stuck in a traffic jam, we have a choice. And too often we go immediately into victim consciousness, thinking, oh, why did this happen to me? Why did this have to happen to me? A few months ago, after making a hospital visit, I was driving to church on 270 South and just, you know, having a great day. It was a beautiful day, and all of a sudden, I came to a dead stop. It was just a traffic jam that you wouldn't believe. Well, for the first 5 minutes, I was calm. I said to myself, well, I've got plenty of time to get there. I have plenty of gas. This is going to be fine. 10 minutes passed, 15 minutes passed, 20 minutes passed, and I was still in the exact same spot. I could feel myself getting agitated and all the things going through my mind. I'm going to be late. I'm going to be late. The person's going to be waiting for me. This is the worst thing that can happen. She'll think I'm irresponsible. This is terrible. I don't have her number. What am I going to do? And all of a sudden, Eric Butterworth's amazing words popped in my head that we all know. You cannot control what happens around you. You cannot control what happens to you, but you can always control what? What happens within you. And so that allowed me to breathe, take a deep breath, get myself a little bit centered, and I said to myself, you know, this is a relative thing. 2 weeks from now, I'm not going to remember this. I didn't cause it. The people around me didn't cause it. It's okay. It's okay. And at that moment, I thought, what can I do that would be productive with this time? And I've got a new car, and I have Apple Play, and I love it. And I thought, oh, I can check my messages. So I sat on the highway, checked all my messages, and one of them was from the person that I was meeting who told me that she was stuck in the same traffic jam farther south, right? So she and I call that divine synchronicity, and that happens to us all the time, that we don't get trapped in the negativity. And the thing was, when I was doing that, oh, I'm late, I'm late, I'm late, thoughts in kind are held in our minds and reproduce in our consciousness. Not always in the outer, but in our consciousness. So I was on a roll with producing those kind of thoughts. So Paul Hesselbeck says the purpose of metaphysical Christianity and the greatest work that we can do in this life is to choose to perfect our own consciousness. Truly, we have the ability to observe and analyze reactions just as we can look in a mirror and observe and analyze our physical reflection. It's the same kind of thing. And we can do that through our higher awareness through what's called self-observation. One of the most, just let your yes be yes and your no be no, that went with my story. One of our most effective ways to gain self-knowledge is to become a compassionate, non-judgmental observer of our own thoughts, feelings, and emotions. And in order to do this, or way to do this, Reverend Martha Creek produced a CD called Presence and Power. And Kathy, I think we have this on Google Docs, do we not? So raise your hand, Kathy. If you want to get a hold of the CD, it's a great CD. See Kathy and she'll work you through the process. Is that okay? Yeah, that's great. So she does this little thing that I'm just going to share with you. First of all, she advises us to keep a clear distinction always between facts and feelings. So a helpful question that I like to ask myself is, what am I telling myself about this event? And in the traffic jam, I was telling myself I would look irresponsible, it was inexcusable for me to be late. What am I telling myself about the event? Well, Reverend Creek gives this little story. She said, what happens if somebody calls you, or you call somebody and they don't call you back? And maybe you call them a couple times and leave messages and you don't get a return phone call. Well, she says, here's the thing. The mind loves to make up stories. And so we go into this spin of stories. And she says, in order to be coherent, we simply have to stick with the facts. She gives this example. She says, okay, instead we can say, well, Alice obviously doesn't care about me or she would have called me back. We say, she doesn't think I'm important enough for a phone call. She no longer values me as a friend. Maybe she never did. Alice is a cold fish, right? And here we go. You know, pretty soon we built Alice up to be this enemy. She says, instead of that, just observe without judgment. Say to yourself, okay, Alice hasn't called me back yet, and stop there. What we do when our imagination kicks in, and imagination is a spiritual power, it can be used for good or it can be used for ill, but when we do that, what we are doing is we come to believe and live in relationship to that which we made up, right? So we're not living in relationship of what's even relatively true, we're living with what's in our minds. So what do? We have to stop and recognize and observe that we are creating a story. Remember, self-observation is not self-condemnation. It doesn't mean we're going to beat ourselves up, but we might say something like, wait a minute, is all that I'm assuming true? Or is there another possible interpretation? Maybe she didn't get my messages. Maybe Alice is just really busy. Maybe I'll try her again. See, it just lifts it and puts you in a different spot. So keeping clear distinction between what happened and my story leaves me powerful, resourceful, creative, focused, clear about what I'm about to accomplish. It takes me to my spiritual place, right? And in this whole process, I may come to realize that I often base my self-worth, or lack of it, I should say, on others' behaviors or reactions. I'm going to say that again. Sometimes we can realize that we base our whole self-worth on what other people say to us or how other people treat us. And if I can see this without self-judgment, I can be grateful for that insight because it gives me something to work on. We can never let any other human being take away our power, take away who we really are. And security and self-confidence come from knowing the truth of who and what we are. So every challenge and crisis we face, and even more serious ones than the two I highlighted today, every challenge and crisis we face could be an opportunity for us to ask, what power of the Christ do I need to call forth here? What is needed here? Is it peace? Is it harmony? Is it strength? Is it love? Is it faith? Paul Hesselbeck says, you can always use self-observation and self-knowledge to become aware that this event presents you with an inner urge to be more and more the Christ you really are. So knowing ourselves, our true divine identity, helps us be ourselves in an ever-evolving awareness of our oneness with all that is, and that makes all the difference. So let's take a moment now as we prepare for prayer and meditation to affirm the great truth about our God. And this is in your bulletin. This is being said in Unity churches really all over the world. And it is, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Will you affirm that with me? There is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life. God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.